A decade has passed since The Money Masters, a study of nine great investors, was published in 1980. A number of the original masters have left the scene, and new masters have appeared, practitioners, in some cases, of novel or unfamiliar techniques. So it seemed time for another sweep around the horizon. For variety, I've also looked at how some famous institutions and wealthy families handle their investments. I hope listeners enjoy an X-ray view of the complicated and sometimes tortured machinery behind the bland public exteriors. And I have included one eminent subject, Philip Carré, whose perspective of more than 60 years in the business makes him far from new, but all the more instructive. After examining the cases that follow, I will try to sum up what can be learned from them, how these masters differ from their predecessors, and how one can profit from their discoveries. We'll start with Jim Rogers. Highly successful investors sometimes devise novel investment approaches, and Jim Rogers falls in that category. He bets on whole countries. He determines that a country is more promising than is generally believed, and then places his bets there before other investors even realize that the transaction is mechanically possible. For instance, Austria. In 1984, the Austrian stock market had stagnated at barely over half its level of 1961, 23 years earlier. A number of other European countries had passed investment incentives to encourage their capital markets. Rogers saw that the Austrian government was preparing to follow suit. He was sure that European money managers, looking around for whatever hadn't moved yet, would in due course fasten on Austria. He inquired at the New York branch of the principal Austrian bank how a foreigner could invest in Austrian stocks. The bank didn't know. There had been virtually no investment interest in this largely socialist, yet stable and successful country. So little information was available outside Austria that Rogers went to Vienna himself to inquire. At the Ministry of Finance, he asked what political factions or other interests were against the idea of liberalizing the stock market and encouraging foreign investment. When the answer came back, and there were none against, he felt he couldn't miss. One problem did emerge. Morgan Stanley's international index showed Austrian stocks selling at 67 times earnings, an appallingly high number. Upon investigation, though, Rogers discovered that this was a completely misleading statistic, since the index consisted of only nine companies, three of which were losing money. Morgan Stanley also said that the Austrian market had inadequate liquidity. That, however, turned out only to be so because most transactions took place off the exchange. The banks traded actively among one another. Thanks to Morgan Stanley's dismal figures, and probably the intellectual laziness of foreign investors, there was almost no other interest in Austria from abroad. So Rogers placed his bets, and in the very next year, the Kreditanstalt share index rose 145%. Rogers is just as happy to be short a market as long, that is, to sell stocks he doesn't own, in the hope of repurchasing them more cheaply later. It's a lot of fun finding a country nobody knows about, he says. The only thing better is finding a country everybody's bullish on and shorting it. In the same year as his Austrian flyer, he bet on a drop in the Swedish market, which had risen nearly sixfold in 4 years. The sag in the Swedish market was only 10% in the ensuing year, but the particular speculative favorites that Rogers shorted fell by 40 to 60%. Rogers' policy has always been to keep his holdings in his own name in the largest bank in each country, preferably one with an office in New York. He reasons that the largest bank will be the last to go bankrupt if there's a national crisis. Rogers' four tests of a good country to invest in are: first, the country must be doing much better than it had been. Second, it must also be better off than is generally realized. Third, the currency must be convertible. And fourth, there must be liquidity for the investor. I always like to be able to get out of something if I'm wrong, he says. Sometimes Rogers tries his hand in an undiscovered market too early in the game. In 1985, troubles in Iran and Afghanistan had severely curtailed the supply of Oriental carpets to the West. Encouraged by a story that the Nepalese economy was booming, thanks to a surge in demand for carpets there, Rogers journeyed to Kathmandu. It turned out that the market had only nine stocks, thinly traded. Rogers remembers reflecting, as he peered down Main Street Kathmandu, "This is a really primitive society. It's too far away and too complicated, and the lines of communication just don't exist." He decided that a motorcycle trip into the Himalayas was likely to be a better idea than investing there. How does one get a sense of the risks and opportunities in different countries? Through travel and by reading in history and philosophy, not in business school. Rogers says his own success has come from discovering things that others haven't bothered with, places where others haven't gone yet but are about to go. A self-styled poor boy from Alabama, Rogers was raised in Demopolis, population 7,800. The nearest big city, Selma, was 50 miles away. Rogers attended Yale, graduating in 1964. He applied to several graduate schools and had interviews with several company recruiters. One of the interviewers was from Dominic and Dominic. Rogers and the interviewer liked each other, and a job offer resulted. By that time, Rogers had decided to go to Oxford in the fall. He asked the interviewer if he could work just for the summer. This was unusual, but in the end, arranged. At the time, Rogers did not know a stock from a bond, but he fell in love with the securities business almost at once. "What I liked about it was not so much investing money," says Rogers, "because at that time I didn't have any, but that if you were smart, used your wits, and paid attention to the world, it was all you had to do. I was extremely interested in what was going on in the world and used to read voraciously. You didn't have to wear the right tie. You didn't have to join the country club. You could do what you wanted to do, and they would pay you to do it. I thought that was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen." That autumn, he went to Oxford, and by the time he came home to the United States, he realized that his keenest interest was in international finance. Then came 2 years in the Army, where he ran his commanding officer's portfolio and developed a growing determination to make money. "I wanted to make enough so that I would never have to worry about working again," he says. Right after the Army, Rogers worked at Bache, then for Dick Gilder, and subsequently went to work for Neuberger and Berman. While working at Arnold and S. Bleichroeder in 1970, he met George Soros. They formed the most successful twin-star investment team in the business. While they were together, they never had a down year. Soros was the trader, and Rogers specialized in research. The Soros Fund was characterized by independence of thought. Neither Rogers nor Soros has much time for Wall Street research analysts. "They all follow the herd. Nobody gets rich doing that," says Rogers. It's a fast way to bankruptcy. But Rogers does not consider himself as merely a contrarian. You have to be right as well as different. The fund's greatest successes came from an ability to foresee large and general changes, secular as opposed to cyclical. Rogers, who still follows this orientation in his own investing, explained at the time, "We aren't as much interested in what a company is going to earn next quarter as we are in how broad social, economic, and political factors will alter the destiny of an industry or stock group for some time to come. If there is a wide difference between what we see and the market price of a stock, all the better, because then we can make money." This is what Wall Street calls the top-down approach. A decade after inception, Soros and Rogers were still the only thinkers in the firm. In the same period, starting with $12 million under management, the fund had grown to $250 million, one of the factors that prompted Rogers to leave in 1980. He thinks large funds become unmanageable. His share of the profits on leaving came to $14 million. Rogers describes himself as very much a loner, a maverick, a misanthrope. He has a somewhat bohemian point of view and has motorcycled through Latin America and across China. He is planning to leave most of his money to Oxford and Yale for travel fellowships to let others have the same broadening exposure that he had. Students will receive $18,000 a year if they agree to spend 75% of the succeeding 2 years out of their own country. Otherwise, there will be no restrictions. He says, study history and philosophy. Do anything in preference to going to business school. Wait on tables. Hitchhike in the Far East. Only thus, he emphasizes, can they develop a rounded perspective on life. Now retired and running his own money, Rogers ascribes much of his success simply to industriousness. When he joined George Soros, he worked every day nonstop, taking not a single vacation in a 10-year period. "The most important thing in my life was my work," he says, "and at the time, I worked most intensely. I really knew an enormous amount about what was going on in the world, just about everything that any single human could." He says he never felt anxiety about whether he was right when his views differed from everybody else's. "Other people can't sleep at night. I hit the pillow asleep. In domestic portfolio investment, Rogers bets on whole industries in the same way as, when investing abroad, he bets on countries. First, he develops a massive investment concept. He then buys every stock available in an industry that he thinks is set for a turnaround. How does he select the industries? He looks for a major secular change, ignoring fluctuating business conditions. Rogers looks for four principal types of changes. First, disasters. Examples include Lockheed, Chrysler, International Harvester. Company crises of this magnitude imply that the whole industry is in a catastrophic situation. And usually, when an entire industry is in crisis, with two or three major companies bankrupt or on the verge of it, the whole industry is ready for a bounce, as long as there is something in the situation that should change the fundamentals. Second, changes for the worse. When an industry is so popular that investing institutions own 80% of the shares of its top companies, one can be confident that the stocks are overvalued in the market. Rogers will go short many of the stocks in the industry, not just one. And he tries to chart precisely when the major change for the worse is about to take place. Third, new trends. The natural look was an example. When in the 70s women began to turn away from overdone makeup, Rogers studied Avon products and decided that at over 70 times earnings, it was due for a fall. He shorted at $130 and repurchased a year later under $25. Fourth, the last secular change Rogers watches for is when the government decides to act. The government throws money at a problem. Rogers spotted collection agencies when contemplating governmental trends. The government lends to students, small businesses, and a great many others. For decades, it made little attempt to collect this money when due. In the late 1970s, it decided to hand over the job to private collection agencies. Moving $1 billion around means little to the government, but any significant fraction of that can mean an immense change in the fortunes of a small company, which collection agencies usually are. What are Rogers' techniques in stock selection? The important thing, in his view, is to develop a way to think independently. He says, "I have always found it much better just to sit and do your own reading. When I talked to people, it would muddy up my thinking. I found it much easier and more profitable if I just stayed with what I knew very well, not what somebody else told me." While working as a money manager full-time, he used to read newspapers from at least 5 different countries, some 40 periodicals, and about 80 trade journals. He also read hundreds of annual reports and followed insider trading figures for lots of companies. Many of Rogers' investment ideas come from observing the everyday world around us. A typical discovery was Bank One. His broker at Merrill Lynch said that he would appreciate it if Rogers opened a cash management account, which would gain him some points with the firm. Rogers noticed that the checks for the account were drawn on Bank One, which he had never heard of. He looked into the company and found that it had a computer system that was primed to participate in the growth of check and credit card processing for the rest of the big brokers. In due course, he became a shareholder. The stock went from 6 in mid-1980 to 30 in mid-1986. Rogers' outlook for the economy is not optimistic. The U.S. government has lost control. In the last 12 years, the U.S. deficit has risen more than in all the years of the country's history. There has been no case in history of the world's reserve currency being debased this fast. Whatever happens next has to be bad, says Rogers. Soon those abroad lending to the United States will stop doing so. At that point, the government must sit tight and let the U.S. public finance the deficit, try to encourage savings through fiscal policy, and cut spending. Any of these alternatives will hurt the economy. Thus, there will inevitably be a financial crisis. Financial companies will experience extensive bankruptcies. Many Wall Street and Tokyo firms will go out of business. Whether there is a depression at this juncture will be up to the politicians. In all likelihood, though, they will do the wrong thing. But in any event, by 1992, the Republicans will be swept away. In 1988, Rogers expected that the impending financial catastrophe would not necessarily affect the overall economy. Now, however, because of all the overborrowing, he fears that it will indeed spill over into the general public. Wall Street is still crazy. Irrational things continue, such as the Nabisco takeover. New York real estate has been supported by the Wall Street boom. That, however, is over. Rogers is convinced that the art market is also going to collapse, and the way to take advantage of that event is to short Sotheby's stock. Don't think the decline is over before it's over. Rogers is no more sanguine about the rest of the world. The Japanese market stopped going up in 1987, and now Taiwan and Korea are beginning to cave in. The United Kingdom has very high interest rates and an inverted yield curve. Rogers considers the two most remarkable things happening in the world to be the opening of China and the uniting of Europe in 1992. The latter, however, is not necessarily beneficial for the rest of us. Europe will be blocking out foreign imports. This may exacerbate America's problem, even though it apparently helps Europe, at least temporarily. The 21st century will, in any event, be the century of China. The Chinese like to work very hard. They think entrepreneurially. They are prepared to delay gratification for tomorrow's benefit. So, says Rogers, teach your children Chinese. Next, Michael Steinhardt, strategic trader. Michael Steinhardt has had one of the greatest 20-year runs in investment history. If you'd put $10,000 into his hedge fund, Steinhardt Partners, at its inception in July 1967, 20 years later, you would have over $1 million. How does one invest so successfully? One answer is that Steinhardt pays about $35 million a year in commissions to Wall Street brokers. That kind of money can buy masses of research, if that's what you want. And yet, deep Wall Street research is one thing that Michael Steinhardt has almost no interest in. On the desks of most investment people, you see stacks of annual reports and studies from brokers projecting companies' prospects out for years into the future. But if you look around Steinhardt's office, there is scarcely a scrap of paper to be seen. So what does $35 million buy? The answer is that Steinhardt hopes that it gives him a little edge in each of innumerable profit-making transactions. On the other hand, small incremental gains alone would not fully explain his overwhelming success. He has reaped his major rewards from betting on directional moves. As he says, if we get involved in bonds, it's because we expect interest rates to go in a certain direction. I look first at the big picture of where the market is going, and then try to find stocks to fit a portfolio that reflects my generalized view of things. That contrasts with focusing first on companies that have terrific value regardless of the market. Steinhardt could be called a strategic trader. First, he forms a large and general conception like those that we all derive from reading the papers. The yen will go up. Inflation will get worse. It's time for recovery in oil stocks. Having established his conceptual framework, he looks for the specific. Thanks to his commission dollars, he gets incessant calls with fragments of news that suggest profitable trades. Some Wall Street houses have so much influence that when they change an opinion, they can move the market by themselves. Steinhardt wants to get the first call when the key analyst of such a firm changes his mind. Not because the analyst is necessarily right, rather because the people he calls after Steinhardt will think he'll be right. From the broker's standpoint, a great advantage in dealing with Steinhardt is that he will give you an immediate order if he trusts you, without referring the idea to a committee or waiting to think about it. For one urgent telephone call, you can get a 100,000-share order. For Steinhardt, as for a racetrack bettor, the short term, the here and now, is reality. The long term, and Wall Street research that tells you about the long term, is the hereafter, a world of dreams. As a trader, Steinhardt feels much more comfortable carving out little gains, 5%, 10%, 15%, over and over again than he would buying a stock and salting it away to await distant events. I do an enormous amount of trading, says Steinhardt, not necessarily just for profit, but also because it opens up other opportunities. Trading is a catalyst. How I envy the multi-year, long-term investor who fixes on a distant objective and just waits and waits. I'm always just making small moves, but still, most of the money I make is in holdings that I keep for a year or more. There is more to Steinhardt's successes than short-term stock trading. He is also prepared to speculate temporarily on the direction of the general market. He will go long on leverage, and even more to a net short position. I have five or six security analysts, three to four traders, and one economist who look for what sectors of the economy are going to undergo important changes. What I hope I can find using the economist's ideas is the difference between the consensus perception and the variant perception. Steinhardt runs three pools. One, for domestic taxpaying investors, uses extensive leverage, borrowed money. Another one uses less leverage for tax-exempt domestic institutions. And the third is for foreigners. Steinhardt is limited to a maximum of 99 participants in each pool. His oldest vehicle, Steinhardt Partners, may employ leverage when Steinhardt has a lot of confidence in a particular holding. In 1983, he bought 800,000 shares of IBM at $117. The stock had a modest move, advancing 15 points. Then the stock dropped back to 120, giving up most of its gain. Steinhardt had borrowed $100 million to buy his stock at 117 and sold out at approximately 132, making over $10 million. As one associate observed, there's nothing timid about the man. He likes massive moves. Steinhardt's plunge into IBM was triggered by a recommendation from a colleague who had the impression that Steinhardt might buy 20,000 or 50,000 shares. In fact, he bought several hundred thousand. Like most great investors, Steinhardt started poor. He was born in Brooklyn, the son of a jeweler. For his bar mitzvah, his father gave him 100 shares of Penn-Dixie Cement and 100 shares of Columbia Gas System instead of cash. He took to studying broker's reports and following the prices of his stocks in the World Telegram. He started frequenting a Merrill Lynch office, with the old men smoking their cigars and watching the tape. Soon he was buying and selling stocks. An exceptional IQ enabled Steinhardt to finish high school at 16. He attended the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Finance, from which he graduated at 19. In 1960, he went to work doing research for the Calvin Bullock Mutual Fund Organization at $80 a week. He was not a success. He then served in the U.S. Army Reserves before writing briefly for Financial World. His restless brilliance could not be made to focus on such subscriber queries as, "What is your news of General Motors?" much less answer them, and eventually he was fired. "It was awful," he says. "I thought my career on Wall Street was over." Next, Steinhardt worked as a research analyst at Loeb, Rhodes & Company. In a short time, Steinhardt was known as one of the top special situations analysts. He also began exchanging information with another researcher, Howard Berkowitz at A.G. Becker. He introduced Steinhardt to a fraternity brother, Gerald Fine, then managing the partner's capital at Dominick & Dominick. In July 1967, Steinhardt, Fine, and Berkowitz opened its doors with an initial capital of about $7.7 million. They were off to the races. By the end of fiscal 1969, the firm had almost $30 million in capital, making all three of its under 30 founders millionaires. Steinhardt became the chief trader, while Fine and Berkowitz concentrated on research. The firm added staff in the 1970s, but the pace was always, as now, frenetic. "It meant not going to lunch and making trades that involved 14 conversations," says Steinhardt. The decades of intense, almost monomaniacal dedication to investing left Steinhardt feeling that his outlook was too narrow. He yearned for a break. Steinhardt took a sabbatical in 1978. He spent more time with his family and retreated to his 24-acre estate north of New York City. There, he grew raspberries, read the Old Testament with a rabbi, studied horticulture and yoga, and restored a house. After a year, though, he returned to what he calls this glorious business of ours. He says, "The sabbatical allowed me to come back and do largely the same thing that I had done before, but with a broader perspective and fewer questions about the purpose of my work." In any event, it's no longer the money that keeps him on the job. His wealth is estimated at over $100 million. As for his partners, Fine left in 1976 to start his own private investment partnership, and Berkowitz followed suit in 1979. Since then, Steinhardt has managed it alone and done exceedingly well. He owns over 50% of the firm. "I see my role as trying to achieve the best possible return on capital," says Steinhardt, "using the full range of techniques that will allow me to attain that goal without commitment to any particular style. Every day, I ask myself where the risk-reward ratio seems right." Our first concern is long-term investment positions. Second, new issues when they are attractive. We demand and receive large allotments. Third, we lend stocks to brokers to cover short sales, on which we demand the maximum interest. Fourth, we have people doing arbitrage, including buying into bankrupt companies and buying trade claims. Fifth, we avail ourselves of the full range of modern gimmickry, index futures, and the rest of it. I have four or five traders who deal with 80 or 90 brokers, in large measure to open doors. I couldn't achieve these results with long-term investing alone. Most of my long positions are chosen on the basis of their long-term fundamental prospects, not that I necessarily actually do hold them for very long. I often say to my people, make your choices on a long-term basis, even though what we're betting on will probably not happen. I figure out how the market will respond to a long-term prospect, at least for a minimum period. Among several stocks in the same category, Steinhardt greatly prefers to invest in one that has a repurchase program in its own shares. Such a program gives an additional boost to its upward movement and also gives the investor a better chance to sell when the time comes. Looking at his portfolio, one finds no intellectual or philosophical thread. It's a hodgepodge. Still, in most years, two or three holdings make most of the money. By being very active in the market, he is exposed to endless opportunities and is forced to focus on whatever areas of the market are moving at the time. He is, in a word, eclectic. I started as a securities analyst myself, Steinhardt said. Visited managements, studied the relative attractiveness of different industries, and so forth. That was in 1967. People were comfortable thinking in a long-term way. The best minds looked for companies which had the most promising secular growth characteristics. That, of course, led to the Nifty 50 heresy. People were willing to pay much too much for stocks that met those criteria. They became insensitive to value, to the price-earnings multiples. The entrance fee didn't matter. All that led to the debacle of 1973-74. Today, the emphasis is overwhelmingly short-term, on trading techniques and computerization. We're now getting exaggerated in that direction. How is it all going to end? I expect we'll go back to long-term thinking sooner or later. Steinhardt has commented that for most people, himself included, selling short requires a psychological adjustment. One must overcome the idea that one is opposing America, motherhood, and apple pie. Also, it is hard to adjust to the idea that on the short side one can have infinite losses, compared with going long, where one can only lose 100%. However, Steinhardt's own investment principle is that you never make big money in the market without getting in the way of danger. He went out on a limb in 1972 by shorting big-name growth stocks, Polaroid, Xerox, Avon products, at 30 to 35 times earnings, and with dismay then watched the same stocks hit 40 to 45 times earnings before they topped out and produced a sharp gain when the market collapsed in 1973. I asked what sorts of stocks he went short, observing that most good speculators' experience was that one did not make money on the short side, but used the shorts as a balance against a larger long position. On the long side, he answered, I'm looking for lower multiple dull stocks with a recovery potential. On the short side, I want to be in the best-known companies in America, the areas of speculative focus. The stocks I short tend to be reverse of my longs. They're high multiple popular stocks with big institutional expectations built into the prices, which I think will be a disappointment. My perennial problem is the difficulty of timing the breakdown of those speculative expectations. I do tend to short too soon. Steinhardt normally reviews decisions intensively. He goes over his portfolio many times a day. He tends to focus on problems, not on successes. If a stock is acting well that day, relative to the market, fine. If not, he starts asking questions. Something may be wrong. It may be a random movement, but he wants to concentrate on it until he can establish that it is merely random. Steinhardt meets annually with a distinguished economist who each year is astounded that the world has not fallen apart since their last meeting. All these statistics, debt compared with savings, debt compared with GNP, are worse than ever. For his part, Steinhardt says, one cannot help marveling at a system that has coped with the petrodollar shock, with higher and then lower inflation, and the other gyrations we've seen. In the 1960s, people talked of the insolvency of the Federal National Mortgage Association. Now, they're wondering how to dispose of the bad loans in the Texas Panhandle. There's always something. So, what about the stock market in the coming period? The new dominant factor is debt. It will perhaps be the key to the economic future of the Western world, Steinhardt says. The ethics surrounding debt are different. I doubt that anybody could have imagined 6 or so years ago that a president with the conservative stripes of Ronald Reagan would have allowed and encouraged deficits and have run deficits for 6 years, doubling the national debt. The ethics with which he grew up were anathema to that, and yet he did it, and it's been an important part of the economic scene. Debt questions related to quality, to the third world, municipal debt, consumer debt, all have changed so much as to put a different pattern in our life. There has been an enormous growth of debt in the world as compared to earnings or assets or anything else. It amounts to an economic-leaning tower that will eventually topple. It cannot be sustained. The debt will eventually be repudiated and turned to equity, resulting in inflation. What would be the refuge if very bad times came along? If things got very bad because in an economic contraction companies couldn't service some of their bonds, say, and as a result, instead of their hearing endlessly about too much debt, the problem really hit home to investors with defaults and bankruptcies, then liquidity would be the key. Only cash and cash equivalents would save you. Philip Carré, The Money Mind. Philip Carré must be the most experienced investment man around. Having entered the field in the early 1920s, he can boast some 67 years of immersion in the hurly-burly of the market. At 91, he still arrives at his office early every morning. With his two sons, a granddaughter, and a small staff, he runs over $225 million in mostly private portfolios. A CEO from outside the family was finally taken aboard in 1988. But in his 10th decade, Carré seems perfectly unimpaired in faculties. Carré started the Pioneer Fund in May 1928. It had about 25 stockholders, members of his family, and a few friends. He ran it for over half a century, and during that 55-year period, Pioneer's compound annual return was 13%. That means that an original stockholder who had put in $10,000 and reinvested all his income would, at the end, have been able to withdraw over $8 million when Carré left. 13% is not a remarkable performance figure today, but it meant a great deal when inflation was low. Originally, Philip Carré had operated the fund single-handedly. Later, he incorporated the management company and sold most of it to Jack Cogan of Hale & Dorr in Boston. At that point, an investment committee was created. Cogan, Pioneer Fund's director of research, and Carré. The other two were in Boston, so every morning Carré would talk to them on the telephone about what he proposed to do that day. The directors' meetings were cozy and informal. On the board of the Pioneer Fund, there were at one time three octogenarians, Carré, Jerome Preston, and Phil Cooley. From time to time, stockholders thought to question this gerontocratic waiting. Carré always enjoyed that question. He is confident that age brings wisdom. "So, you think we're going to have a depression?" I asked Carré. "Yes, I'm afraid so. This is the first time in my life that I've ever been really bearish. The present situation is so much like 1929 that it's likely to have the same outcome." Carré has always been so optimistic. It has been a shock to some of his friends to realize that he now anticipates a serious break, indeed, a depression, in the early 1990s. "I don't see how we can wring the debt out of the economy without a depression," he says. "There's just too much of it. In a business, debt is quite reasonable, but margin debt, stock market debt, is terribly dangerous because it's so easy to get. You can just pick up the telephone and generate debt in the stock market." Carré thinks the next crash could come without warning. "I've been selling stocks and buying bonds," he says. "General Electric credits, IBM credits, that sort of stuff. I still have lots of stock, though. Water companies, that kind of thing. Conservative, well-financed companies that will see you through the hard times." Studying the careers and methods of extremely successful investors, I had come increasingly to the conclusion that they often actually invented a way of investing, or at least revived one. I asked Carré to identify his own contribution. I like over-the-counter stocks, he said, and yet I'm more conservative than most people. Most people think that conservative means General Electric, IBM, etc. But I've always been in offbeat stuff. They're less subject to manipulation than New York Stock Exchange companies and are less affected by crowd psychology. Now all sorts of junk is sold over-the-counter, but also some crown jewels. Berkshire Hathaway, for instance, until recently traded over-the-counter. Carré said he knew Warren Buffett, who runs it. He's a friend of mine. He's smarter than I am. He proved that in General Foods. It was a stodgy company, mostly coffee. When Berkshire Hathaway bought the stock, I said to myself, well, Warren's made a mistake this time. It was about $60 when I noticed the transaction. In a matter of months, it went to $120. Carré has a deep, throaty chuckle when he tells stories of this sort. He particularly enjoys tales describing common opinions that are completely mistaken. Carré is, in a way, an older version of Warren Buffett. They are quite similar in appearance, round-headed men with wide grins. Both have a completely contrarian mentality. They seek what nobody else wants. Both like dull stocks, such as waterworks or bridge companies, and do not mind if these sit dead in the water for long periods. Especially, both have the patient temperament of the successful value investor. Carré does like good balance sheets. He gets floods of annual reports and looks at them all briefly. If I see that the equity ratio is low, or the current ratio is low, I don't go any further. I want no term debt and a better than 2-to-1 current ratio. If it's a utility, I want reasonable financial ratios, a good territory, and a favorable regulatory climate. I'm a collector of odd little outfits. For instance, one of my favorite stocks is Magma Power. I've had it in the family for years. Magma has a great advantage, which is that under California law, a neighboring utility is obliged to buy any power Magma generates at the highest avoided cost. So it has an absolutely guaranteed market. That's a pretty good thing to have in a depression. It's not what everybody would call a conservative holding. They might never have heard of it. But to me, it's very conservative. I asked him how small a company he felt comfortable with in terms of market capitalization or sales. I have no fixed rules, but I usually prefer several hundred or several thousand stockholders and a market capitalization of at least $50 million. Another important criterion for me is that I always want to see management own a significant amount of stock. An officer should have at least a year's salary invested in the business. If he doesn't have that much faith in the company, he shouldn't be a key executive of it. If they don't own a lot of stock, why should I own any? Asks Carré, adding that he always looks for large insider shareholdings and proxy statements. Did Carré always get to know management personally? It's desirable, he says, but there are only so many hours in the day. I have too many stocks to know everybody concerned. I might say that I'm always turned off by an overly optimistic letter from the president in the annual report. If his letter is mildly pessimistic, to me, that's a good sign. A person of evident frankness and honesty, Carré does not hesitate to express and act on his opinions, which are often strongly held. Some people do not care for this traditional New England downright manner. Others find it praiseworthy. A friend described Carré as being at peace with himself, a strong, solid character with no inner misgivings. Philip Carré was born in Lynn, Massachusetts, 10 miles north of Boston. He completed Harvard College and a year of business school. This being World War I, he then joined the aviation section of the Army Signal Corps. Discharged in 1919, he went to work for a little firm in Boston, long since defunct. He started at $15 a week. After 5 months, he got a raise to $20. Feeling that so small an advance was insulting, he quit. He then decided to wander around the United States, and by November of 1920, found a job selling bonds in Seattle, where he met his wife, Elizabeth Osgood. They returned together to Boston, and he really had two jobs, as a feature writer for Barron's and a reporter on the staff of the Boston News Bureau. This lasted until 1927, when he decided to come to New York to make his fortune. Carré was hired at Blythe & Company as the house economist. Blythe, together with several foreign banks, formed an early investment trust called American, British, and Continental Investment Company. Carré ran the portfolio on a day-to-day basis. Blythe let Carré go in 1932, during the Depression. So Carré hung up his own shingle, the best thing that ever happened to him, he now thinks. but he didn't like it then. At the outset, he had two partners, one his own former assistant at Blythe, and the other a salesman. Like everybody who started out in the Depression, they operated with extreme frugality for their first 10 years. His salesman partner brought along a clientele, but as Carré says, the rest of us rang doorbells, literally. Carré has a name for what he says is the particular mentality of the good investor, the money mind. To illustrate it, he cites a story. Years ago, New York went through one of its periodic droughts. You had to ask for a glass of water in a restaurant. Carré remembered an area in Queens he had learned about, where the city collected its water charges on the basis not of consumption, but of the front footage of each residence. He reflected that the city would eventually have to install water meters there, so that a distinction could be made between households that consumed a lot of water and those that consumed less. He studied the subject and found that the likely candidate for the business would be Neptune Meter. He looked up the company and saw that one of the directors, an officer of Bankers Trust, held 2,000 shares, an encouraging sign. The company's figures were favorable. So Carré bought the stock for his clients and over the years was well rewarded. The money mind, he says, is just a quirk like the mathematical mind. In 1939, raw sugar sold for less than 1 cent a pound. Then came war. Carré knew that in wartime, the price of sugar always rises. He sought out a Cuban sugar company with 20,000 shares outstanding, of which 13,000 were controlled by the Royal Bank of Canada. In the course of being reorganized, the company had acquired a whole spectrum of different securities, mortgages, income debentures, preferred, and the rest, with the common stock, the tail end of the dog. So when sugar prices rose, the common stock skyrocketed. He bought a little at $1.75, a lot more at $7 to $8. He sold most of it at $60, and the last little bit at $200. When I invest, I gamble with a certain amount of my capital, buying dogs, Carré says. The usual way I lose is by buying concept stocks. They rarely work. Still, one interests me just now. Flow systems. They use a jet of water under very high pressure to cut solid objects, steel or even stacks of paper. It's a neglected stock, mostly, I suppose, because it hasn't made much money yet. Looking at his desk, which had 3 or 4 inches of annual reports, letters, and papers on it, I said it certainly conveyed an impression of industry. I'm not sure that desk has ever actually been bare, said Carré. When I was back at Blythe, the department I was in was called Economic Research. They discontinued economic research when they fired me. They didn't need the equipment, so I was able to buy this desk for $1. It served me very well for 60 years. Old money. New money that has learned to survive. To turn new money into old, that is, preserve your savings and make them grow, a family must somehow grasp 3 truths. First, the problem is extremely difficult. The rest of society yearns to erase the claim on it represented by your capital and pursues that objective unremittingly through tax, inflation, regulation, and other weapons. In the unending duel between the saver and society, society almost always wins in time. Most family fortunes are eventually undermined. The second truth to grasp is that the task of managing capital well can only be achieved by someone who is able and experienced and gives it the closest attention. So usually, a family's best strategy is to hire and carefully supervise a superior specialist, the way one hires a surgeon or a lawyer. The third truth is that finding that superior specialist is itself a difficult job. The best investors rarely deal with individual clients. Then, the best probably won't even stay the best. They get too big, and there's always a succession problem. So the family must understand this subject well enough to be able to preside over the process. How have some famous families gone about doing it? A while back, the Rockefeller Family Office announced that it was forming the Rockefeller Trust Company to administer some 170 trusts for individual family members. Despite a 5-generation tradition of keeping financial doings hidden inside the family, and indeed hidden from much of the family, I would bet that Rockefeller Trust will in time share its investment savvy with outsiders as a full-fledged investment counsel firm. In much the same way, the Phipps family in-house investment officer, Bessemer Trust, decided in 1974 to look for outside accounts. One prized non-family client was the then White House Chief of Staff, Donald Regan, who placed his blind trust with Bessemer when he became Treasury Secretary in 1981. President Reagan took advantage of the evolution of yet another family office, Starwood, which looked after the Sears Roebuck fortune of the Rosenwald and Stern eras. Is this a trend? And when the family office opens its doors to hoi polloi, does that create a good opportunity for families of lesser means to seek financial advice? Or does it make more sense to go to an investment advisor who has never been dominated by a single family? Let us consider in more detail these two standard solutions to family financial management. I'll start with some generalities and then examine a few specific examples.